Welcome to the 130th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 33 years to the day that Australia beat India by a single run in what was the narrowest victory in World Cup history. Welcome to the podcast that always aims to provide thrilling excitement.
And thrilling excitement for this episode will come in the form of Jason Gillespie leaving England. A wonderful feature about a guy called Major Nigel Bennett. Never heard of him, nor had I. Andy's going to introduce us. And we're going to be reviewing Beyond the Boundary, the new Netflix documentary about the women's 2020 T20 World Cup. That's always a complicated one. But before all of that, Andy, you recently had a close encounter with an icon of the game in a pretty unexpected setting.
Well, it was. I wish it had been slightly closer, but we'll get to that. I was walking past the idyllic Kew Cricket Club, and it really is idyllic, beautiful ground by the river. And I was en route to a wedding, and I spotted a man painting by the boundary rope. And a fellow guest bounded up to me and told me that it was none other than former England wicketkeeper Jack Russell. I should really have worked this out for myself, because even from a distance, that proud moustache was visible.
Did he have the hat on as well?
He did. His old tatty hat on, and he had a very fetching kind of fleece as well. He looked like I don't know what a painter is supposed to look like, but he looked a bit more sort of artisan than artist, perhaps. But, you know, a more dedicated and go-get-em podcast host would have run across to grab an exclusive interview. But I was sadly hamstrung by the fact that I had ushering responsibilities at this wedding. But we often sort of wonder about, you know, life after cricket. You know, what do these players do who've played at the height of the game, you know, Lords, etc.? And there was something about the sight of Jack Russell standing there on this gorgeous late summer day, brush in hand, with a small admiring crowd of his own, you know, much more focused on his painting than the cricket. And he looked like a man who's found a very successful second life after cricket.
There is always a question when you see, you know, ex-cricketers in a forum like that. You know, you say that you were out of time to bound up to him and, you know, get the Reverse Web Radio interview. But there's also something in my mind, which is clearly he's there because he wants to paint and he's just loving it. And there's always that tension about, do you go up to someone like that, and, you know, introduce yourself and just not necessarily, you know, grab an interview, but say hi to them. I have that tension kind of a bit when I see people, you know, around the corridors of the ABC where I work. Occasionally you see, you know, people in the other end of the corridor. And it's always that odd one, isn't it? That you feel like you have that connection with these people because we read about them and we watch them and everything else. But at the same time, someone like Jack Russell sitting there painting, what an idyllic scene. And he's probably so self-contented in that.
Well, I totally share that. I think for me, there is always a terror of being inane. You don't want to come up and sort of say, oh, I really liked you as a wicketkeeper, Jack. You know, you feel like you've got to do better than that. You know, clearly many of the good folk of Kew were having absolutely no qualms. He had, as I said, a sort of motley crowd assembled around him. But yes, I agree. It's an art, the going up to a cricketing hero. It's one that requires a bit of practice. And well, this is your item is something that makes me feel very old, because somehow I think we all remember Jason Gillespie as the bounding seamer, and now we're talking about him almost reflecting on his time as a coach in England.
Exactly. So, I mean, Jason Gillespie has been around in cricket kind of for as long as I can remember. You know, I suppose Jason Gillespie is seared into my mind as part of that Australian lineup that made it absolutely impossible to think that England would ever win the Ashes. You know, in a way, he played second fiddle to, you know, Brett Lee, Shane Warne, Glenn McGrath in that bowling lineup. But still, he was very much a part of that. And I suppose, partly for that reason, because he was always a sort of arch nemesis of England, partly for that reason, it seemed in a way a bit incongruous when he came and he took over the job in 2011 of coaching Yorkshire. It was quite a big decision in a number of ways. He was an iconic Aussie for a start, and Yorkshire is often is historically a very kind of closed shop to, you know, people from the rest of England, let alone people from the other side of the world. And because Yorkshire were kind of on the ropes at that point, they'd just dropped to the second division for the first time in a long time, and for a very proud cricketing county, that was, you know, something that didn't go down too well. But during his time as coach there from 2011 to now, and he's actually, I think, just stepped on a plane back to, got one of those hotly contested seats on a plane back to Australia at the moment. He did a few things, I think, one of which was that he turned the fortunes of the Yorkshire cricket side around into a side that was, you know, a contender across all formats of the county game. He's also, under his watch, has been a kind of generation of quite astonishing cricketers that have come through. Joe Root and Johnny Bairstow are the really obvious ones there. But the other thing that's really remarkable is it's very rare that someone comes into a setup like that, is there for 10 years and comes away having seemingly won the respect of everyone in the game. There was a story that was being told over the last week as he kind of stepped down from the job about Azeem Rafiq, who, you know, in quite a well-publicised case, was talking about the racism that he'd received while during his time at Yorkshire. And he actually called out Gillespie as being, you know, someone who was really on the right side when it came to all of this. No one usually comes out well from those kind of situations, particularly not people at the top. And so it's an interesting moment to reflect on what is quite a remarkable contribution, I think, that Gillespie's made to the English game, ironically, for someone who caused such terror in the English game as well before that.
I've always had some faith in the theory that many of the best coaches were not the top, top, top players. And as you made clear at the start, I mean, Gillespie absolutely was a top player, but within that side, he was always slightly second rank, wasn't he? He always had to play the support act to the McGraths, the Warnes, the Lees. And I do sometimes wonder if that doesn't make you the better coach, because somehow the naturally talented geniuses just get stuff done through genius. The second tier have to figure things out a bit more, and I sometimes wonder whether that doesn't lead to a better rounded.
Well,
figure.
it was a point, I can't remember what book we were reading recently, but it was a point that was made there, exactly that sometimes the best players cannot understand why people can't just hit a perfect cover drive off the middle every single time. You know, they just can't understand that, and so therefore their ability to nurture people who are struggling is quite limited. And actually, one of the things that Gillespie's done at Yorkshire is he's taken a couple of players and seen them through their kind of reinvention. So people like Johnny Bairstow, people like Liam Plunkett as well, who have actually completely had a bit of a kind of mid-career crisis and reinvented themselves. Gillespie was actually able to be a part of that process, where someone who, you know, was a natural genius from an early age probably couldn't have gone on that journey in the same way. From the archives, and in Reverse Swept Radio, we, I suppose, pride ourselves in going into some pretty dusty, hidden corners of the game. And Andy's going to be taking us into just one of those corners right now, in a feature about the accidental captain, the curious tale of Major Nigel Bennett.
Major Nigel Bennett had popped into the Oval to renew his membership. It's 1946, and he was presumably looking forward to watching some county cricket. You know, this was the first time in 6 years that he was going to have that opportunity. The pavilion clerk, which I think sounds like a rather wonderful job, took his membership papers through to the club secretary and chairman. Now, it just so happened on this particular day that they were on the lookout for a Major Bennett. Following the withdrawal of Surrey's first choice candidate, they needed an amateur to lead the team. So this was still at the point where, you know, the pros did most of the work, but you always needed an amateur in charge. And they decided that the man for the job was successful club cricketer Major Leo Bennett. They missed that this Major Bennett in reception was a Nigel, and promptly offered him the captaincy.
What's interesting here is that just coming out of the Second World War, and now someone called Major introducing themselves Major, you'd think that that was kind of, in a way, a substitute for a Christian name because there's so few Majors around. But it's just like saying Mister, in a way. You know, anyone of a particular age would have been elevated to some kind of a rank in the armed forces. So it does seem a bit of an oversight not to have kind of checked that.
It is not the first thing in this tale that you will hear and you will think that sounds ridiculous and improbable. And yes, in an act of negligence that I think should really shame cricket historians and journalists, no one ever appears to have got around to asking Major Nigel Bennett for his account of what happened. And I think you'll realise as we go through the details that it would have been great to hear his take on some of the bizarre things that did take place. Wisden did ask Sir Alec Bedser, who played under the Major's accidental captaincy. Bedser called it the cock-up, a pretty simple, clear assessment, and blamed it on the chaos at the Oval at the time. So the ground had been used as a prisoner of war camp. Desperate scramble was underway to be ready for a new season that many had wondered would whether it would happen or not. What I don't really understand is why Surrey didn't simply admit their mistake and reverse the decision. I don't know whether they were afraid to admit an error or perhaps it was considered just very bad etiquette.
So hang on. So they realised kind of straight away almost. I mean, did they know what the Major Bennett they wanted actually looked like? I mean, how far did this actually go as a misunderstanding?
Well, It went far enough that he captained Surrey for the entire 1946 season. But where things get murky, and I think this is perhaps partly why they didn't retract the decision and perhaps partly why Major Nigel said yes, was the offer was a mistake but not a completely ridiculous one. So Nigel Bennett had actually been the leading batsman at Stowe back in 1930, Stowe School.
A leading public school, yeah.
Right, and had even played a couple of games for Surrey Second 11 back in the 1930s. So for him, I think he would have been quite taken aback to get the offer, but perhaps he would have said, OK, well, times are tough. However, it's very clear that he did not rate himself as a cricketer. So, for a batsman, he began his new career as Surrey captain at number 8 and was very soon coming out at 9, 10 and even 11. There are a couple of anecdotes that show how his captaincy unravelled rather fast. He upset Surrey's stalwart pace bowler Alf Gover by rolling the new ball along the ground repeatedly, earning him a lecture on the importance of protecting the shine. In a later game, he had asked the young Jim Laker to open the bowling, and when Laker told him he was an off-spinner, Bennett apparently replied by saying, "But you do bowl quick too, don't you?" Now, I struggle with these anecdotes, because surely, you know, Major Bennett had played at Stowe, he'd played a couple of games for the Surrey Second 11. How was he quite so naive? Yet, for players at the time, you know, these stories have been repeated again and again, so... there's a little bit of a puzzle to that.
But there's surely also a naivety about someone who... I mean, this whole story, you kind of wonder whether it's a great... I'm waiting for you to get to the end and say, oh, it's actually April Fool's and this is a massive sort of send-up, because it is the kind of thing that just feels like a, you know, a kind of a fictional tale. But there is a sort of also a certain naivety to someone who turns up to renew their membership and is told, great, you can't renew your membership because you're actually going to be playing on the pitch, and doesn't go, hang on, what's going on here, / I don't think I'm quite qualified for this too. So you do wonder what kind of, you know, particularly with some of these, you know, Jim Laker's in the team, sure, a youngish Jim Laker, but, you know, a very accomplished bowler even by that point. You do wonder why, and maybe it is part of this amateur thing, you know, the fact that there was a culture of having unqualified, effectively unqualified amateurs who, because of their class and because of the fact they'd been to public school, ended up captaining sides. So in a way, maybe it's not so surprising that this person sort of felt the entitlement, Major Bennett felt the entitlement to turn out and lead a whole lot of people when he wasn't qualified to do it.
I think that's right. I think there must have been something about the culture in of the time that things were just a bit more chaotic. And, you know, the nature of the fact that, you know, weeks before the season they were scrambling around for a captain made this possible. Now, some Surrey players were more relaxed than others. One anonymous player said, "I reckon we can cope with him for the summer. His wife's a real cracker." So there you go.
That's what you look for in a captain, apparently.
Apparently so. It was not a successful season. Surrey finished 11th, which was at that point the lowest position in their history. And wisdom decreed rather, well, I was going to say bluntly, but they decreed with a tone that only wisdom can, that want of knowledge of county cricket on the field presented an unconquerable hindrance to the satisfactory accomplishment of arduous duties, which I think is the wisdom equivalent of a ticking off.
Yes.
Now, I'm inclined to come to Major Bennett's defence, because surely the more experienced players did their bit, or should have done their bit, to help direct proceedings. And although a bad captain undoubtedly does hurt a team, they can't be held responsible for everything. I mean, if you made me, you know, captain of Surrey next season in the county championship, you know, they'd probably have to carry me a little bit
just for the batting.
But even if I repeatedly made terrible decisions, you know, the batsmen could still score runs, bowlers could still take wickets. It feels a little bit tough to pull this all on Major Bennett.
The other thing is that poor old Major Bennett, we just don't know, to your earlier point, what was going on behind the scenes. Because if the kind of, you know, Surrey committee and the players had banded together and said, this is absolutely impossible, we can't work with him anymore, surely they could just have got rid of him. You know, it wasn't as though he was the person who said, I'm now the captain and there's no way you're going to get rid of me. It's up to surely the broader structure to admit that they've made a mistake and move on. And it's weird that they didn't at any point do that, and really interesting to know whether, you know, at what point they did realize they'd made a mistake. Maybe still no one knows what this guy's first name is.
And this exactly feels like the missing bit of this story, and why I desperately wish someone had got round to interviewing Major Nigel, because we'd love to know what was going on behind the scenes, what he was thinking. You know, was it some sense of duty? He averaged just 16 with the bat, but he did have his moments. There was a 79 against Kent. According to the Times, his innings included strokes to the offside that even his most ardent admirers had not expected of him. I wonder
that's
if
damning
this
with faint praise. You know, when you've just scored your probably debut county 50, that's not exactly how you'd want it written up, is it?
No, and you also get the sense that the Times correspondent knew that his ardent admirers were perhaps a non-existent species.
Exactly.
So his end of the season comes. Bennett's duty is relieved of his duties. Surrey did improve and finished sixth the following season, which perhaps adds weight to the theory that Bennett was holding them back. He moved to the West Country, where he worked for a tennis court construction firm and played cricket for Taunton. When he died in 2008, the headline on his Times obituary was "The Strange Case of the Captain Picked by Mistake." To the review, and for this episode, we've been watching Beyond the Boundary, a documentary on Netflix that came out a couple of months ago in August, is directed by Anna Stone, and is actually a production by the ICC. Toby, what is this documentary set out to do?
Well, I think the fact that it is an ICC production that is on Netflix, you know, the world's biggest video streaming platform, really says something about it. You know, it's a broad audience play, as I think they say in the TV industry. And really, it's all about evangelising for women's cricket. It's the story of the 2020 T20 World Cup in 1 hour, in actually a bit under 1 hour. It's a documentary that focuses, I think, less on the cricket and more on the kind of human stories behind the World Cup, some of these teams as well. So at the top of the documentary, one of the things I thought was quite interesting and quite inspiring, actually, was that at the top of the documentary, they film a lot of the players up at Taronga Zoo, just a few kilometres away from where I'm recording now. And they ask a lot of the captains about what they're looking forward to in this World Cup. And none of them say, I'm looking forward to winning the World Cup. They all say, I'm looking forward to this opportunity to promote the women's game and to get more people into the women's game. And I think this documentary really springboards off that, in terms of it's a piece of, as I say, evangelism about the women's game.
Taronga Zoo must play a role in seemingly every cricketing event, or perhaps every sporting event in Australia. I feel like there's obligatory pre-tournament shots with
koalas.
Player and koala, yes, are very key. It's an interesting format. In some ways, it's not really a documentary at all. And this is not necessarily criticism, but just to give you an idea of the sort of pace of the programme. It's really a video montage. We go from sort of highlights to highlights, very brief interview clips. all with a kind of soundtrack. And I think the, as you say, it's about evangelism, and it's very convincing in that way. I think one of the things I slightly struggled with is just to try and work out who the audience is. And maybe this is always a challenge with a game like cricket, because I felt if you were very, very, you know, into cricket already, what you're probably looking for is something a bit more like the test, right? You're looking for that more in depth on the game, etc. But I wondered that if you were actually new, you know, really new to the game, did it give you enough to have a clue what was going on the field? Or maybe that's important.
But I don't know whether
important.
That's the point. Are they? Is that what 2020, you know, World Cups are trying to do? Or are they trying to draw people in through that sense of getting to know some of the characters and to become invested in that? And that was one of the things that they really focused on, was they picked a few kind of human interest stories, one of which was the Thailand team, and the, you know, infectious smiles of the Thailand team was a kind of recurring thing that came back through the... through that, there was the, you know, injury to Elise Perry, you know, and that kind of heartbreak moment that they kind of, you know, Elise Perry becomes someone that they tell the narrative about. And so I think that they, you know, trying to bring out characters. And in that way, I kind of, you know, felt a bit closer to some of those players. One of the things that I think that meant there was less of was actually seeing some of the cricket. So they show some quite extensive highlights of the first game, the India-Australia game, where India end up beating Australia in a bit of an upset. And there's that amazing spell that Poonam Yadav bowls, and including getting Elisa Healy in that first game. And we see three highlights of that ball, but none of them you actually see the ball. It's all about just seeing the players' faces and their reactions. And I was actually kind of ended up going on YouTube and looking it up, because I wanted to see that spell and what actually happened in terms of her bowling. And there is very little of that. But I dare say probably that we're not, as people who are clearly cricket tragics, I dare say we're not the target audience in that sense. What would you take out of this, though? What would you remember from the documentary?
I mean, you certainly made the point about the Thai team, and I think they are clearly memorable. I think this combination of just sort of enthusiasm, but also the fact that, you know, they acquit themselves well, actually. You know, they are well beaten, but they, you know, they do put up some performances as well. I mean, I was rather struck by, and this is where cricket just refuses to cooperate, I was rather struck by the challenge that the documentary makers were left with when the semi-final between England and India is rained off. Yes. So you're left with having to just take atmospheric shots of the rain, atmospheric shots of sad England players, when really you should be, you know, giving a great event. And then, of course, the finale is actually very, very one-sided. And I think the documentary maker desperately scrambles to kind of create excitement, but actually that final was a pretty grim final in the end, wasn't it? You know, Australia kind of, so I think
Australia post a big score and then India just totally collapse, and the documentary makers very heavily lean on the appearance of Katy Perry in that final as being the kind of moment that really kind of defines the game rather than the cricket, which is probably in a way fair, but doesn't necessarily do a great service to the cricket.
And Katy Perry, who appears to actually be having a rather wonderful time, and, you know, speaks very sort of well on how she sees the occasion. In terms of things, I'll remember the parade of dancing cricket bats behind Katy Perry is a memorable sight. I think depending on how you feel about dancing cricket bats, that's either something for your dreams or your nightmares. I know you pulled out Shefali Verma, who was quite extraordinary as a performer, and also at doing all of this at the heart of that Indian batting lineup, age 16.
It's quite, and you have to keep on reminding yourself that, I think, you know, when there's a kind of packed MCC, I think over 100,000 people in the MCG, sorry, for that game, and the 16-year-old who's part of the Indian collapse, but yet she's the person, and the commentators say it when she comes out, you know, she is the person who could win this for India if she fires, and she gets out. I think it's even a golden duck or something like that, you know, but she gets out very, very early, and she's absolutely inconsolable. And you suddenly realise here's a 16-year-old who's been thrust into this limelight. And in how few other sports, certainly it's very rare. I mean, Tendulkar probably is the last, you know, cricketer to have played at that age, at that level. How rare it is to have, you know, cricketers put under this kind of spotlight.
So I think we both enjoyed it. It was something a little bit different. And for someone who, perhaps for someone in your life who you're trying to engage with the game, who's never really wanted to give it a chance, this might be a way in.
And that was the 130th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Find us on Twitter at Reverse Swept to continue the conversation. Leave a review for us over on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks.